Society has little patience or affection for women who stray from our ingrained image of femininity. Hillary Clinton, too shrill. Melissa McCarthy, too fat. Serena Williams, too strong. Too gross, too slutty, too old. And ultimately, too unruly. In Ann Helen Peterson's new book, Too Fat, Too Slutty, Too Loud, The Rise and Fall of the Unruly Woman, each chapter looks at a different female celebrity and breaks down all the ways society has deemed she's doing it wrong by being herself. The book is published by Random House, and I'm happy it brings Anne on the show today. Hi, Anne.
Hi, so happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you. In your introduction, you talk about how you would have revised this book if you had written it now, meaning after this Me Too moment that we've all been living amidst. What would you have changed? What has changed in the last just several months that you would have loved to have been able to insert in the book?
Yeah, you know, I had to revise the book already once majorly because the election happened. You know, I submitted my final draft about a month before the 2016 election, and that included a chapter on Hillary Clinton, and then had to do a bunch of rewrites to think through, you know, how was the rejection of Clinton part of this kind of backlash against unruly women. And so, but what I've thought through since then is how that election also mobilized an untold number of women to be more outspoken, to be more unruly in their own lives and in ways that have had, you know, national and international ramifications. So whether that includes running for office or, you know, speaking very publicly, saying, like, we will not tolerate this kind of behavior any longer as part of the Me Too movement, that has just, I would love to reconsider that.
Would the Me Too moment, as we've been experiencing it, have happened if there was a President Hillary Clinton right now?
Oh, that's such a hard hypothetical, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, I think I've talked to many people doing activist work who are incredibly energized and are so excited to be part of what, you know, they refer to it as like the blue wave. But at the same time, is it worth having the suffering and fear that has been incurred through the presidency, you know, is it worth it just to get some women who are in the position to be fired up? But I do think, you know, a reckoning, sometimes you do need things to get bad enough for people to take something seriously. So, you know, I don't know. One would hope, but at the same time, I don't know if people would be as brazen, as willing to put themselves on the line as, you know, to say that this is not okay.
Throughout the book, the word unruliness keeps coming up as women's most undesirable trait. And you, of course, chose it as the adjective in the title of your book, The Rise and Fall of the Unruly Woman. Why that word?
So unruly, I actually, you know, stole that word from a graduate advisor who she wrote a book about unruliness as it applied to Roseanne, which is especially interesting to think about in light of what's happened to Roseanne over, you know, the last 6 months.
Yes.
But she was writing about Roseanne in the 1990s and how Roseanne became this kind of beacon of both like fascination and repulsion of like, oh, I can't take my eyes off of her, but like I know that I have to reject her particular embodiment of femininity, both in terms of like she's too brash, she's too powerful, she's too large, all these different things. And, you know, now she's still unruly, but it's like she's too conspiracy theorist, she's too racist.
Right.
You know, and for me, that points to the ways in which unruliness is not inherently progressive quality.
Huh.
It can be, you know, you could say Omarosa is unruly. But I do think that there are a lot of ways that unruliness tests the boundaries of what proper, in quotes, femininity is in a way that does actually offer progressive or forward-moving ideas of what a woman can be.
Those boundaries, are they created by men?
I mean, you could say they're created by, like, society, which is patriarchal, right? And women participate in them. You know, one of the things I talk about in the book is how, as women, we oftentimes find ourselves censoring other women who were like, oh, gosh, her dress is too tight, or, like, she needs to quiet down.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's been socialized, that when you see someone who is acting out of bounds in that way, that you gossip about them, or you reject them from your social sphere, or you don't hire them, you know, all these different things that women participate in the perpetuation of these rules, these understandings. And I think, you know, one way, people always ask me, like, how can I be better about this? And one way is being mindful of, or not embarrassed by your own unruly qualities, mm-hmm. but then also kind of watching yourself when you react that way, being like, why do I think that that's too tight of a dress? You know, what's telling me that it's that way?
If you're just joining us, I'm Matt Katz. You're listening to Midday on WNYC, and my guest is Anne Helen Peterson, who's the author of the new book, Too Fat, Too Slutty, Too Loud, The Rise and Fall of the Unruly Woman, published by Random House. And what are women supposed to do with this recurring complaint that they're, quote, not pleasant enough?
I mean, I think you can use it as a weapon, right? Like, you can use it as a way to say, I don't care what you think about me, and I'm going to do what I want to do in order to affect change. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, the banner year for female candidates shows that, right? That, like, many women have said, like, oh, wouldn't it be embarrassing to my family? Maybe if I run for office, wouldn't it just be, like, I don't know, it's something that I wouldn't do. But so many women have been encouraged by others, by their family, by their friends, by the media to run, and are poised to win, or, you know, at least to swing the conversation about the election in a different direction. So I think you can use others, you know, underestimation of what a woman is possible can do,
right,
to your benefit.
What's your hypothesis about why Melissa McCarthy, who you profile, was able to become the superstar she is, despite not fitting into this classic Hollywood image of femininity?
Well, she's so fascinating. And, you know, there are antecedents. There are people like Mae West from the 1930s who, you know, she at the time, if you look at the magazine articles about her, she inspired a trend against reducing, which was like the 1930s word for dieting, basically saying, like, oh, like a voluptuous woman can be sexy. So there are people before, you know, it's not just that that Melissa McCarthy is like the first larger woman who has ever been successful.
Yeah.
But I think she, you know, really digging into the way that she has responded to questions in interviews and how she has, like, marketed her clothing line and that sort of thing, is she is super careful to balance all of her incredibly unruly humor on the screen with this very ruly and domestic and, you know, kind, nice, ruly personality off screen. Mm. So whether it's in, you know, a profile for Rolling Stone or on the cover of People magazine, she even says, like, I go into a fugue state when I'm doing this humor. Like, it's a different person. So that makes her personality more palatable and less threatening.
What do you make of the fact that she's often put into these sort of traditional male roles, like buddy cop or spy, Ghostbuster, for example?
I mean, that's the thing, that men can always be unruly. You
yeah.
know, like, sometimes people ask me, is it possible for a man to be unruly? And I'm like, you know, for like a traditional masculine man, like, that's just being a man. Like, you yeah. know, speaking out of turn, doing what you want, acting, dressing how you want, like, those are the privileges that are afforded to dominant masculinity. But so I think that what happens when she is cast in these roles that might traditionally have been written for men is that she is taking on the powers and freedoms afforded men mm-hmm. in a way that, you know, I think she does a masterful, she's hilarious. Like, what she does with that power is incredible, but it's only because of that liberation of not having to hew to these expectations of what a woman should be.
You have a quote in the chapter about Broad City, the show Broad City, men's bodily functions are funny, women's are obscene. In whose eyes is that? Is that where how it's traditionally been viewed? Is that how the Hollywood establishment still views these things?
Well, I think increasingly women's bodily functions can be funny, right? But I just remember, like,
progress.
A joke that I would repeat in junior high and high school, which is, like, women don't poop. And, you know, it was funny, like, you'd be like, oh, I don't have to worry about that because girls don't poop.
Right.
And, but really what it was doing is it was erasing any sort of, like, abjectness from the female body. You know, you pretend, whether it's, you know, body humor in any sort of way, you pretend it doesn't exist, you erase it so that it doesn't trouble that understanding of women as, like, clean and pure.
Mm-hmm.
When, of course, that's not the case.
women do poop, you're saying.
End of periods and give birth, you know, like all of these messy things. But we create that fiction that is impossible to uphold.
Very good. I'm Matt Katz, and I'm speaking with BuzzFeed culture writer Ann Helen Peterson about her book, Too Fat, Too Slutty, Too Loud. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Matt Katz, and I'm speaking with Ann Helen Peterson, a BuzzFeed writer and author of Too Fat, Too Slutty, Too Loud, The Rise and Fall of the Unruly Woman. And you profile several different women, and I wanted to ask about Nicki Minaj, the musical artist. How does she use her physicality and sexuality as a business asset?
You know, I think her case study was particularly complex because, you know, there's different ways that you can think of wielding sexuality and wielding one's body and self-objectification when it comes to when you're talking about a white straight woman or a black woman, right? Like there's a different history of who has been able to commodify, to self-commodify. So sometimes, you know, one of my learning curve things as a white feminist is to try to just listen to a lot of black feminist women writing and thinking about women like Nicki Minaj and where she falls on that spectrum. So I think one of the things that she does is she is incredibly purposeful about how she wields that sexuality. And, you know, when she was first coming up as a rapper, there were attempts to try to really hypersexualize her and turn her into just someone who doesn't actually have any talent.
Mm-hmm.
And she rejected that and really took on these costumes and these different personas as a way of deflecting from that. And it wasn't until she gained her, you know, first kind of wave of success that then she decided, okay, so I've legitimized myself. Now I can play around with wielding my sexuality and my body and, you know, with things like Anaconda, which are, you know, it's a funny video. It's a funny song.
Mm-hmm.
And she's doing it very purposefully. But I think sometimes there's a knee-jerk reaction to be like, well, there's a butt on the cover of this album, so she doesn't, you know, she doesn't know what she's doing. She's not a feminist. She, you know, all these different things when it requires a lot more consideration than one might think.
So by doing that, she's thumbing her nose at those perceptions and trying to say that, you know, she's owning it in a way. Is that what she's doing?
Yeah, I think so. You know, one thing I noticed over the course of, you know, reading all of her interviews is that she is a control freak. Like, she does everything with purpose, everything with knowledge. And so if she's choosing to do that, she's doing it very mindfully and doing it very purposefully, not as just like a, oh, this is fun, or like, oh, this will sell album covers. But she's playing around with different other people's assumptions about, you know, what someone using their bodily assets like that, what that means, what kind of person she is.
And a woman of color, too. And,
yes.
And you try to take an intersectional approach to these issues because it is different. There's a difference between being unruly as a single white woman and being unruly as a person of color.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's like I pounded into the intro of the book that there's part of the reason there's more white women in the book than there are women of color is that it's just a safer space to be unruly if you're a white straight woman. Like, you are not pressing boundaries in other ways, so it's easier to do it with your actions or with your comedy.
You're listening to WNYC, the Midday Show on WNYC, and we're talking to Ann Helen Peterson about her book, Too Fat, Too Slutty, Too Loud. How has society's image of pregnancy done what you call a complete 180 in just the last couple of decades.
Oh, this was so fascinating to research because I really grew up almost entirely in an age of public pregnancy. So I have like a vivid memory of Demi Moore on the cover of Vanity Fair. Naked with the pregnant body. And I didn't realize that even seeing that in the supermarket, that was a rarity because many, many supermarkets across the United States, you know, covered it up or banned it as indecent. And that really was the overwhelming understanding of a fully pregnant body, was that it was indecent in some way, that you kept it, had bed rest, or went into your confinement, as they used to say. And that was because of this idea that your body became so monstrous that it couldn't perform femininity properly. So it had to be hidden until after the birth, after a certain amount of time after the birth. And then what's happened over the last 20 years, really, is that the pregnant body has become yet another way in which women have to perform cuteness and control. And, you know, one of the scholars that I cite talks about maintaining, like, the cute pregnancy. And the cute pregnancy is, it looks like you've swallowed a basketball, and then a couple months later, it looks like you no longer have swallowed that basketball.
Right.
And, you know, it's like the Kate Middleton pregnancy. And yeah. The chapter that I talk about this in is the Kim Kardashian chapter, and I look at how her first pregnancy was at the same time as Kate Middleton's first pregnancy. And they became these case studies in, like, how to properly perform pregnancy, like, as a feminine, you know, well-to-do woman who's part of the aristocracy, and how Kim just defied all of that. Like, her body refused to have a cute pregnancy, mm-hmm. and then she dressed her body in a way that also did, you know, emphasized the ways in which her body couldn't do that. So that, you know, that's the chapter that I have to get the most response from. It's from women saying, like, I felt this so strongly during my pregnancy that I was not doing pregnancy right because I wasn't cute.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's a hard thing because in some ways you're like, yeah, at least we get to be pregnant in the open again. But then as soon as something goes into the open, then you have all these, you know, expectations of femininity that attend it.
The backlash that comes with it. Cardi B was just on the cover of Rolling Stone. She's not one of your unruly women, but she probably qualifies as an unruly woman. She was on the cover of Rolling Stone, right? Nude, very pregnant with her partner. Do these images of famous women bearing their pregnancy in all of its glory, does that help other women deal with the struggles of being pregnant and being in the workforce and being, you know, making their way throughout the world in times when, you know, they could be sidelined because of their pregnancy or not feel viewed as beautiful or not given the sense within themselves that they're beautiful by other people? Does it help to have these famous women out front doing this for them, being on the cover of a magazine, nude and pregnant?
Well, I think that, you know, the more representations, the better in terms of, like, because if you only have one, right, if you only have one way of being nude and pregnant on the cover of a magazine, then that makes people believe that this is the only way to be pregnant in public. And I think that whether it's Cardi B or last year, Serena Williams, you know, having this incredibly strong, athletic black body on the cover of Vanity Fair. But there needs to be more, too, right? Like, there's just so many different ways. And I think that the only way to stop feeling bad about one's inability to have the pregnancy that anyone else does is to see so many different representations.
Got to go back where we began with Hillary Clinton. She used the word unruly in her final email to supporters after conceding the race. Why do some men feel like Hillary Clinton emasculates them, even if they maybe won't acknowledge it like that? They do seem to feel emasculated by Hillary in some way. Why is that?
You know, I've heard the more facile explanation is that she sounds like they're lecturing mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really what that's an expression of is that men don't like to be told what to do by a woman specifically, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so any woman who wields power, they're become, instead of saying directly like, oh, you know what? Like, a woman in power makes me vaguely insecure in my masculinity. There are all these different deflections about, like, oh, this woman is crazy. This woman is shrill.
Right.
You know, and I've seen it now. Like, Nancy Pelosi has really taken on a lot of the qualities that were previously affixed to Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's, you know, calling her crazy or calling her a witch. I saw a meme the other day that it was Nancy Pelosi and
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, yeah, the soon-to-be congresswoman from Queens and the Bronx, who you, yeah, I saw your tweet about it. You,
yes.
Yeah, the meme called them both crazy, right?
Yes, and it was like old crazy and new crazy. And to me, that, first of all, their politics are incredibly dissimilar.
Right.
But it's yoking together, like, oh, a woman is in power, like, she's crazy, right? This hysteria that becomes affixed to any time a woman becomes threatening. And that's a way to defang their unruliness. But I think, you know, the fact it just seems so, it's trying so hard. It's so obvious what the ideology is doing there that I don't think it's very effective.
But if it works, it works both with men and women, I guess, right? I mean, at least it has traditionally.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, and again, going back to the beginning, like, this is something, these are ideologies that women absolutely participate in. So, I mean, patriarchy is not something that's made by men. Like, it is an agreed upon way that the world functions. So in order for that to change, and in order for, you know, anything about our society to change, it has to be, you know, something that changes with the agreement and the cooperation of both men and women.
Are both men and women buying your book, reading your book?
You know, it's hard because, like, my book has a pink cover. And, you know, with the way that books are sold these days, you have to make that big sell with the cover.
Sure.
So it appeals to women. I just tell men, first of all, like, how it actually is unruly for a man to be reading a book with a pink cover. So you are practicing unruliness by reading it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for joining me today. I'm Matt Katz, and I've been speaking with BuzzFeed culture writer Anne Helen Peterson about her book, Too Fat, Too Slutty, Too Loud. It's for both men and women.